the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Listeners do support this program, and I'm quite grateful to Andrew Krieger, Bill Lackamacher, Joan Falber, and Jerry Taylor. They all voluntarily subscribe to this program. You can do it, too. Go to peterbcollins.com. The links are on the right-hand side of the homepage, and our voluntary subscriptions start at $5 a month.
Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. No more backward thinking.
Later in this podcast, we'll meet Ian Brennan. He's an interesting guy. He's worked in the music business as a producer, songwriter, a promoter of benefit concerts, and he supported that artistic endeavor by working in various clinics where he became an expert on anger management. And his new book is called Anger Antidotes: How Not to Lose Your Shit. But first, a wake-up call has been sounded in Fitzwalkerstan, also known as the great state of Wisconsin. And our intro music of the moment is by the Violent Femmes from their album Viva Wisconsin.
Just last night I was reminded of just how bad it had got and just how sick I had become.
Well, that's Wisconsin for you. Ever since Republican Governor Scott Walker took over with Republican majorities in both houses of the legislature this past January, first he ratcheted up the deficit with some tasty tax cuts for corporate interests. Then, because of the crisis he had created, he said, we got to bust the unions. And then they passed the so-called budget repair bill, which has been now overturned by a Superior Court-level judge and is on its way to the Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin. That is now the flashpoint because, as you know, there was an election held on April 5th to choose between incumbent Fred Prosser and challenger Joanne Kloppenburg. And on election the morning after the election, Kloppenburg was ahead by a couple of hundred votes. And then, wow, just like magic, just like a tornado or a twister that could have hit in Joplin, Missouri or Springfield, Massachusetts, a very partisan elections official in Waukesha County discovered 14,000 missing votes. And when those were added, Mr. Prosser, the Republican and an ally of Governor Walker, was declared the winner. And that proceeded to a recount. And from there, we go to Brad Friedman of bradblog.com, our go-to guy about election integrity or the lack thereof.
Hey, Peter, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing okay, Brad, but this is a twisted story in a spring that was filled with twisters.
Yeah, it really has been a remarkable story, remarkable on a lot of levels, not the least of which is the lack of coverage. I know that you and I have talked for many years about how, you know, the media doesn't bother to report on problems in the electoral system, but something that was this obvious and this horrible, you know, and this well-documented, frankly, to be ignored by the media, what we saw during the recount. And you know that you and I have talked over the years during many a recount. We've seen a lot of messes. We've seen a lot of irregularities. But I got to tell you, I think this count up in Wisconsin really takes the cake. I mean, it was a disaster to, you know, anybody who bothered to watch. If you didn't bother to watch, then I guess everything was just fine. And out of 1.5 million votes counted, Joanne Kloppenburg gained 300 votes on Justice David Prosser. So everything is fine. She, you know, he had originally, after the big Waukesha switch, he ended up with about 7,500 votes lead over Kloppenburg. She gained 300 during the recount, and that's pretty much the way the media reports it. They don't talk about the extraordinary irregularities we saw. They don't talk about the number of miscounted votes that there really were. You know, this is something that we've seen in the past in these sorts of recounts. You know, if you've got, let's say, 50 miscounted votes are discovered in one ward during the recount. Let's say Kloppenburg gains 50, but in the next ward she lost 50. The media will report it as if it was a perfect count. They found no mistakes. That's, you know, rather than saying, well, there was 100 miscounted votes. What we saw were thousands of miscounted votes, all of which have sort of gone down the memory hole with the media's meme that, well, she gained 300 votes. None of that, of course. So the number of miscounted votes, a huge number of miscounted votes, and they only had a partial hand count, by the way. And then add to that all of the huge irregularities that we saw: opened ballot bags, ripped, torn, tamper evidence, seals missing, serial numbers missing, scratched out, changed, duct taped bags, pull tapes, one of which, for example, was...
Now, just wait a minute. Yeah. Are you talking about an election conducted in the United States? What you just described sounds like the Karzai election in Afghanistan.
No. Those are much cleaner and easier to oversee.
That
is really what the kind of election that we had here. I mean, disaster after disaster, and yet at the end of the day, the officials say, oh, everything was fine. I mean, hell, in the Karzai race, at least, you know, pretty much everybody walked away agreeing there was fraud. And then, you know, they didn't do anything about it for political reasons. But here, everybody's pretending that there really was no problem. Now, I shouldn't say everybody is pretending, because Kloppenburg, when she finally gave her concession early in the week, she pointed out all of these extraordinary irregularities, a lot of them. She asked for reforms to be made by the State Election Board, which is called the Government Accountability Board, ironically enough, mm-hmm. or the GAB. And even the GAB themselves, you know, understated the fact that, well, we found some problems that can be corrected, that we hope will be corrected for future elections. But that was sort of what it was left at. And so the good people of Wisconsin ultimately at this point have no idea who actually won or lost that election once again, because they have an election system in Wisconsin that fails to get it right on election night and has, you know, terrible follow-up procedures that allow for thousands and thousands of bags to fall out of the secure chain of custody, such that no one even knows at this point if the ballots counted during the recount were actually the ballots that were cast on election day. I interviewed Joanne Kloppenburg earlier this week, and, you know, asked her directly about that. And I said, you know, do you know, now that you have conceded, now that the GAB has certified the results as quote unquote correct, do you know that the ballots counted in the recount were actually the ones cast by the voters? And she said, well, we don't know. Some election, huh?
Well, and first of all, Brad, I want to underscore what you said a moment ago, that the corporate media in this country shamefully failed to cover these issues. And it really is pivotal, because if David Prosser, and I may have called him Fred again earlier, excuse me if I did.
You did.
There's a long-serving state senator in Wisconsin. I think his name is Fred Risser. And I interviewed him a few months back when they were out of state. And so I guess I'm confusing Risser and Prosser. But anyway, his name is David Prosser. Mm-hmm. And presuming that there are no further antics and he returns to the bench, He should recuse himself from reviewing the so-called budget repair bill when it comes before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But I'll bet you he views recusal the same way Chief or Supreme Court Justices Scalia and Thomas do, that it'll be difficult to get him to do that. But it does redound to your credit, Brad, that you have covered this in depth. And for listeners who haven't been to Brad Blog in the past 5 weeks, I want to encourage you to visit. The files are still there, and right on the homepage are the links to the sequence of stories that Brad Friedman has reported on this critical election. And Brad, I wonder if you might compare the process as you observed it in Wisconsin this year with the process just 2 years ago in neighboring Minnesota, where Al Franken ultimately defeated Norm Coleman for the U.S. Senate seat. That was a recount that you followed in great depth. It appeared to be extremely meticulous and quite transparent. Yeah. And I don't get the sense that either of those adjectives applies to what has occurred recently in Wisconsin.
No, it really doesn't. I mean, you couldn't find a more stark contrast. The recount in Minnesota should make all Minnesotans quite proud, frankly. It was transparent. It was meticulous. It was, ballot by ballot. Everyone was able to look and to decide and to fight about, who the vote was for. Was it for Franken? Was it for Coleman? But it was all done transparently. The chain of custody was excellent for the ballots. It was the complete opposite across the border. I mean, it was just a haphazard, different standards in each and every county. There's 72 different counties in Wisconsin, different standards. When problems were found, there were essentially, the Kloppenburg's attorneys were able to issue objections when they saw a ballot that they disagreed with the way it was being counted, or when they saw bags of ballots, hundreds at a time, that they had questions about, because the ballot bags were so wide open you could put in a ream of ballots, you could pull out a ream of ballots without affecting the bag at all. I mean, it was just remarkable.
Let me just add that those bags were reported to have been sealed when they left the precincts.
That's right. They were, and clerks testified as much. They said, well, and the way it works in Minnesota is, I'm sorry, in Wisconsin, is that in each county, elections are then run on the municipal level. So you actually have different systems within each county. But municipal clerks would show up at the recount, and they would say, well, the bags when they left Brookfield, they were sealed, and we sent them to the county where you have a county clerk like Kathy Nicholas, the one who announced the 14,000 votes 2 days after the election that are said to have come from Brookfield. The Brookfield clerk said, well, they were sealed up when they left here. And then they went, highway workers took them to the county, and they were in Kathy Nicholas's possession for 3 weeks. And then they were finally counted across the month, about three weeks of counting in Waukesha. And when they showed up, they were open, and the tamper evidence seals were missing, were torn, were ripped, whatever it was. And, so the Kloppenburg attorneys would issue objections. The folks overseeing, the board of canvassers overseeing the recounting in Waukesha would say, okay, objection noted, it's in the minutes, we're going to count the ballots anyway, and later on, after the recount is done, if you would like to challenge the election in a judicial review, that'll be up to you, and you can use this material for evidence or something like that. Well, as it turns out, the minutes of the recount in Waukesha County are still not posted to this day, despite the fact that it has been, I think, almost 2 weeks since the counting ended in Waukesha. It's been a full week since the Government Accountability Board certified the election as correct. And yet when we spoke with them last week, they said, no, we don't even have the minutes. They haven't been turned over by the county, and we probably won't get them for another 2 weeks, according to the county. So the state officials, the top election authorities in the state, did not even bother to look at the evidence. Some more than 800 exhibits were entered into the record. They didn't even look at those exhibits. Now, many of those exhibits are likely the photographs of these open ballot bags, which, thank you for mentioning, you can find throughout all of our stories over the past month at bradblog.com. We've got the pictures. There were people there taking photographs, and you can see these open ballot bags. You can see these duct-taped ballot bags. You can see the slot for the serial number on the bag that has been crossed out and replaced with a different number or no number at all on the bag. You know, the evidence was right there. You can see, by the way, the tape, the poll tape from Pewaukee, the city of Pewaukee, that has the official results total on the printed poll tape. But the printed poll tape, for some unexplained reason, is dated 7 days before the election.
Ooh.
It was an April 5th election.
Right.
The poll tape is dated March 30th. Hello? Is there a problem there? And, you know, I can't imagine in Wisconsin something like that going by without it being dealt with in some fashion. But, you know, this was just another day in the counting of elections in this dog and pony show that they were putting on in Wisconsin for the last month. That there is still no explanation for a poll tape dated 7 days prior is extraordinary. Now, also, let's add to that something, Peter, that you and I have talked about many times over the years. There were machines. They use direct recording electronic or touchscreen voting machines, DREs, in pretty much all the counties for disabled voters who choose to use them. They use them when they run out of ballots and so when they run out of paper ballots. Luckily, most of the ballots were cast on paper, but so they had a lot of DRE votes all across the state, and looking through some of the minutes from some of the counties, and Joanne Kloppenberg says there's a lot more than I've been able to find, but I can find, and I have quoted and reported on three different cities in two different counties in which when they went to count the tapes that come off of these touchscreen, the so-called voter verifiable paper audit trails that come off these touchscreen machines that voters are supposed to confirm as accurate before they hit the cast vote button. In three different cities, two different counties, those tapes were completely blank because apparently, they say, the poll workers put the tape rolls in backwards, so they didn't print at all.
Hmm.
Now, what makes that most troubling to me is that nobody bothered to report it, which means nobody even noticed that there was no poll tape printing out with these DRE, with these touchscreen machines. You know, for years, you and I both have talked to election officials who say, well, you know, the touchscreen machines are fine because the voters will approve the little paper trail receipt before they hit the cast vote button. Well, clearly they didn't, certainly in these three cities, because nobody ever noticed there was no such paper trail printing out. And I suspect that was happening all over the state, and I suspect it happens everywhere where they use these touchscreen machines. As I've long argued, nobody checks the paper trail. And here we actually have evidence of that up in Wisconsin as part of this disastrous, quote-unquote, recount.
So, Brad, tell me your thoughts about Wisconsin's GAB, the Government Accountability Board, because our friend John Nichols has been reporting quite a bit on this, and I interviewed him last week, and he pointed out that the GAB is comprised of retired judges, and so it's not just retired politicians or people who are overtly partisan. And he points to that as a reason that we can find credible the work of the GAB. Now, to what extent did they oversee this partial recount in Wisconsin?
that's a tough question to answer, because in theory, they oversaw the count. They're, you know, in charge of the count in that regard. Statutorily, they're supposed to oversee the entire recount. They give directives to the counties. Now, apparently, they can give directives to the counties, but the counties don't have to bother to follow those directives. For example, throughout the count, the day before the count began, they gave a very specific form to the counties as far as what numbers they should report back to the GAB each night after the counting ended. And as you remember, in Minnesota, it was something that was very easy to follow, you know, how many votes each candidate had gained or lost in the count each day. Well, one of the numbers that they directed counties to give was for total ballots cast. Now, that means, you know, the total number of ballots cast, even if there is a vote on it or not for the Supreme Court race. And this is one of the ways we can monitor whether there was a huge undervote in any particular town or county and so forth. Well, there was county after county that simply did not turn over those total ballots cast every day. And I had asked the GAB about it weeks ago, and they said, yeah, well, we asked them to do it, but, you know, statutorily they're not required to give it to us, even though we've told them about it. And I said, well, you know, this is an important number for those of us who are following this. And they said, yeah, we understand, and we're trying to get it from them. Well, weeks and weeks went by, and I kept checking, and they kept saying, yes, I know, they still haven't given it to us. We've asked many times, but they haven't given these numbers to us. So apparently, either the GAB doesn't have much teeth, or they're not bothering to exercise those teeth if they happen to have them. And then when it comes to the certification, apparently they certify. We know they certified the race as quote-unquote correct before they looked at thousands of pages and hundreds of exhibits from Waukesha that were in those minutes, because they don't have them. The other 71 counties, it's likely they did not bother to look at those minutes either, as one of their attorneys, Michael Haas is the guy's name, said, well, the minutes have nothing to do with whether we certify or not. So what do they base their certification on? What do they base the, you know, their signature that the results here are correct? What do they base it on? Who knows? Nothing. I mean, they base it on whatever the counties tell them, no matter how many objections, no matter how many problems there were with those ballots. So they don't have a lot of teeth. It's questionable how much power they have versus how much they exercised. In other words, I can't tell, frankly, whether they chose not to enforce the statutes or whether that's just not their place to do so. You know, as far as are they legitimate, are they biased, are they non-biased, I don't know. They made a lot of mistakes, I can tell you that. Their numbers changed all the time throughout the month. They did a lot of questionable things. Are they straight up? I don't know. But I do know at the end of the day, there seems to be no accountability, no oversight. The only way that any of these questions could ever be answered is if the candidate herself, in this case Joanne Kloppenburg, decided to file for a judicial review and raise the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars that it would cost for a candidate to go to court to look into all of these things that it seems to me the GAB should have looked into in the first place while the count was ongoing.
Well, let's listen now to a portion of Joanne Kloppenburg's concession statement. She spoke to the media in Wisconsin on Tuesday, May 31st.
Over the past 5 weeks, clerks and volunteers in Wisconsin's 72 counties have worked hard and long on the recount of the April 5th election. Over the course of their work, votes were found to be miscounted in every county in the state. Over 150 ballot bags containing tens of thousands of votes were found open, unsealed, or torn. Waukesha County had twice as many torn, open, or unsealed bags as every other county in the state combined. In many cases, municipal clerks in Waukesha testified that the bags weren't torn when they left the cities, towns, and villages, So the security breaches occurred sometime when the bags were in Waukesha County's custody. Most every county and most every reporting unit statewide had discrepancies in reconciling poll books in which the number of voters and the number of absentee ballots is recorded. In several counties, including Dane, Milwaukee, Marquette, and Jackson, missing or unaccounted ballots were found in unexpected places during the recount, such as a clerk's office or left in machines. This recount should serve as a wake-up call to improve Wisconsin's election processes. There is, however, ample evidence that the election processes by which ballots are supposed to be handled, recorded, secured, and counted are not followed because those rules are either misunderstood or simply ignored. As a result, thousands of votes are not counted, were not counted correctly, or have been called into question. But in the course of the recount, we have seen that election procedures are not always followed or well understood. We discovered that compliance with statutory responsibles is greatly uneven. There are unacceptable gaps in ballot security, which, if allowed to continue, threaten the integrity of Wisconsin elections and undermine the confidence that Wisconsin residents deserve to have in the results of those elections. Widespread irregularities, unintentional as they may be, around the state, along with the cascade of irregularities in Waukesha County, make it clear that we must do more to ensure that the electoral process in Wisconsin is beyond reproach. That is why my campaign is today submitting a letter to the Government Accountability Board, which summarizes the anomalies, irregularities, and in some cases, the unexplained mysteries uncovered in this recount.
So, Brad, as we listen to Joanne Kloppenberg's remarks, she does go to great lengths to point out the problems in this election, the glaring issues with custody of the ballots, and the uncertainty that she expressed in the radio interview with you about the final outcome. But it strikes me as I read part of this here, she said, "We are also doing the right thing by declining to pursue legal action. Based on the record established in this recount and based on Wisconsin law, the will of the electors has been determined. It is time to learn from this recount, fix the problems it uncovered, and ensure that future elections are different." But I can't respect her position here because of what you just told us.
Yeah.
She's saying that the will of the electors has been determined and that the record established in this recount. Well, you just blew huge holes in the recount process and its credibility, yet she's sucking it up here, taking one for I don't know which team. But it is reminiscent of Al Gore's concession and also John Kerry's concession in 2000 and 2004, respectively, where they appeared to want to avoid being cast as sore losers. Well, after getting this far from the original election on April 5th,
yeah,
I think Joanne Kloppenberg had little to lose by really pursuing her rights up to the limit. And I don't know about her ability to raise the money and what all that would have entailed. But just on the fundamentals here, it seems that she let us all down by conceding at this point and then claiming that, you know, while we got to fix the system, that this is an accurate count and she's going to respect it.
You raise a lot in that question. So let me hit a few points. One, and I don't want to let this go, the difference between Gore and Kerry. Gore, to his credit, I think, pushed his election just about as far as he could go before the country potentially breaks out in civil war. He did go all the way to the Supreme Court. He was largely out of options at the time that he finally, stepped aside and said, you know, for the good of the country, we need to move forward.
But
four years later,
just a sec on that. My point is that he was half-hearted and he was somewhat political in his demands for partial recounts in Florida. And the delay, the dithering, allowed the Republicans to go to the Supreme Court, which remarkably ordered the counting of votes to stop. And so, you know, I think there were a number of mistakes made there. I'll accept your notion, although I don't really believe that we were on the verge of civil war. I thought the American public was remarkably composed in watching the post-election struggles in Florida, and that, you know, we really didn't see any breakdown in our government structure. If anything, it was disappointing to see Bush and Cheney planning their transition well before the Supreme Court decided the election.
Well, we can certainly debate the tactics that he used, the strategy that he used throughout the recount process, Al Gore, back in 2000. And my point wasn't really to litigate that, but was to say that for good or bad, doing it well or not, he did push it just about, I think, anyway, just about as far as it could go. I'm not sure where you go after it's shut down constitutionally by the Supreme Court. I don't know what you do next. Now, we can talk about that if you want, but my point was largely to say that was different, very different, than what happened 4 years later mm-hmm. when John Kerry folded the next day
right.
and made no attempt to have those ballots counted in Ohio. Add to that the fact that it was 4 years later, the real menace presented by the Bush administration and who they were and the type of government they would be was well known 4 years later. If you had
yes.
any question about, you know, how Bush would, preside in 2000, there was no question about it in 2004. And so that's why, you know, I think it was a very different case. And when I look back at, you know, what has happened, where the Supreme Court now is, I firmly blame John Kerry, not Al Gore, because of that distinction.
Okay.
So
I accept your point.
All right. With that said, then, we move forward to Joanne Kloppenburg, an equally, arguably, tenuous and important and tumultuous point in the nation's history now, certainly in Wisconsin history at this moment. She had every reason on those political grounds to continue the fight. With that said, and I don't mean to be an apologist for her in any way, But what I'm trying to do is share some of what I believe was her thinking. For one, she was an independent candidate. She had no major party backing her, unlike David Prosser, who, though he claims to be a Republican or an independent now because it's supposed to be a nonpartisan office, this guy is a hard right Republican partisan. He was the Speaker of the Assembly in Wisconsin, Kathy Nicholas, the county clerk out there in Waukesha, she is a hard right partisan and unabashed activist for the GOP. She also, by the way, was his former colleague.
Right.
So this guy, you know, is a Republican and had the Republican backing. Joanne Kloppenburg did not really have any major party backing. Now, she might have been able to go out and ask for it. She might have been able to go out and ask the unions for their support. I don't believe that she did, although she put out the signs that, you know, she was willing to fight this. And the unions really did not show up after the election, to my knowledge. They certainly showed up, you know, in the lead up to the election and helped her get as close as she did, but they didn't show up afterwards. So a lot of this would have had to have been on her shoulders,
mm-hmm.
and the costs of it, which would have been very costly going up against the Republicans, would have had to have been on her shoulders. We would have learned a lot throughout the process. We might have even sniffed out the bad guys here and thrown a few people in jail if she had taken it as far as I think it needed to go. But being able to afford to do that is another thing, both financially and, yes, politically. And I'll tell you, I was following this in the Wisconsin media throughout the month, and I have never seen an assault on someone the way they were assaulting this woman, saying that, you know, she should have never asked for this recount. It was a huge waste of money. I mean, you know, the predictable stuff that you're going to get from the right. But, I mean, it was coming from the mainstream media as well. the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who before the count was even over said that Kloppenburg should call it off, that it was outrageous. Of course, the Journal Sentinel didn't bother to point out that they had endorsed David Prosser, but they were unrelenting there. So it would have been no easy feat to face this assault from the media, from the politicians, and then having to be financially responsible for it all. That's a tall burden to carry, and then add to that the laws, the statutes, and the case law makes it really, really hard to challenge an election, and to a certain extent, appropriately so. It should not be easy to overturn an election. But Wisconsin, I think, makes it as hard or harder than other states as well. So even if you have hundreds and thousands of ballots that nobody can vouch for their authenticity, nobody can vouch for them because the chain of custody has been broken, there are huge question marks in the statutes and in the case law about what the hell you do about it from there. So even a successful case, had she brought it, there's a question about whether the election could have been overturned. So there were some high hurdles to climb. So it's hard, frankly, for me to be too hard on her because of that.
So you give her higher marks than Francine Busby.
I do, actually.
And that's an inside one for listeners who don't know. She, we believe, won the special election to replace Duke Cunningham in San Diego when? In 2006?
2006.
Yeah. And it was taken away from her. The Republican former lobbyist, that's Bill Bray, right? Was certified by the Republican Secretary of State before all the votes were counted and sworn in, and then they said, what you going to do about it?
Exactly.
And Francine Busby didn't have a clear idea about what to do about it.
Yeah, she did. And by the way, I don't know if she won or lost. So if you say you believe it, that's fine. I don't know. And that's the problem with so many of these elections. We don't know. I mean, to this day, all of these things that I rattled off and that you heard Kloppenburg rattle off, these are absolutely true, absolutely provable. They should be reported. They should be investigated. I think people should be horrified about them. I think if the situation was reversed and if it was a case of a Republican winning by 204 votes on election night and then a Democratic activist county clerk showed up and said, oh, look, 14,000 votes that I forgot to tell you about 2 days ago. And then all of these bags showed up open as they have and everything else. This would be a completely different story. And people, they would be burning down Wisconsin at this point if there was not accountability over it. So had the situations been reversed, it certainly would have been something else. That said, we still don't know what we have here. We still don't know if, you find 10,000 ballots that nobody can vouch for their chain of custody. That doesn't mean that they were fraudulent. That means we can't vouch for the chain of custody. They are either legitimate or they are not. What do you do at that point? Do you throw them out? Do you risk disenfranchising 10,000 voters? Maybe so. If you count those ballots, do you also risk disenfranchising 10,000 voters, the voters who had their ballots replaced by these fake ones, if they were faked? This is the problem that you get into. This is the mess. This is why, I'll say it again, you have to get it right on election night, or you're going to run into these problems that really have no good solution. And that's what they did once again in Wisconsin.
Yeah. So, Brad, I want to talk about one other thing before we close here.
Yeah.
What else would you like to add about the Prosser-Kloppenburg race, this frustrating recount, and the litter that remains on the electoral landscape of Wisconsin?
I will say this. Kloppenburg has asked for certain reforms to the system. She's asked that of the GAB. Some of them they might be able to do. Others have to be done legislatively. Obviously, given the legislative situation in Wisconsin, I don't think anything is going to be done because, remember, Wisconsin is one of the states that recently put in place, new voter suppression laws to keep people from voting through these photo ID restrictions at the polling place, despite, no evidence of voter fraud whatsoever. Election fraud remains a problem. voter fraud, apparently not so much, but that the legislature was able to do something about, and Governor Scott Walker was happy to sign into law prior to these recalls coming up, which are going to be run under the same system that, frankly, there is no reason to have confidence in. But where people in Wisconsin are listening to this podcast, what can you do? You can keep your eyes on the polls. You can keep your eyes on the ballots as well as possible. You're not done when you cast your vote on Election Day. Stick around. Watch the counting to the extent that you're allowed to. Document it. Bring your video cameras. Bring your cell phone cameras. You know, if we had pictures of those very same ballot bags all tightly sealed up, with a certain number on them, on election night, and then we're able to show the same bag of ballots with the number scratched out, a different number, and wide open, and nobody able to explain it, maybe something would have been different here. So until they come to their senses, until they realize that ballots, paper ballots, need to be counted by hand in front of the citizenry, in front of all parties, in front of all video cameras on election night at the polling place with results posted at the polling place before those ballots move anywhere, we are going to have these problems again and again and again in election after election. Don't be surprised if it happens in these upcoming recall elections. So far, six Republicans will be up for recall. Perhaps three Democrats. We'll see. There are charges of fraud in collecting the signatures for those Democratic senators.
Right.
So we'll see if those come up.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to see these same problems, and we're going to see them again in 2012 until somebody finally pays attention to what you and I, Peter, have been screaming about for so many years. It's not getting better. It's getting worse. But what is getting better is that more and more people, I think, are noticing. So there are a good group of folks up in Wisconsin who saw what happened here and who are hopefully going to be on the case earlier this time around when these recalls start in July.
And listeners, you can read all about it at bradblog.com. He's done an excellent job of pulling this story as it developed together. And I just give Brad you very high marks for the coverage you've offered. Now, another issue that you've covered very well is the slanderous activities of one Andrew Breitbart.
Who?
Andrew Breitbart.
Not ringing a bell.
Well, one delicious moment a few weeks ago on Bill Maher's HBO show, Laura Flanders, the progressive host of Grit TV, and she's got a PBS syndicated show that's starting up this fall called The Laura Flanders Show. I was just cheering for her because kind of in the middle of nowhere, she just went off on Breitbart.
Yep.
And it was really, I think, well-deserved and overdue and an oversight of Bill Maher's because he's had Breitbart on twice since the O'Keefe Giles phony ho-pimp takedown of Acorn. And subsequent activities, including Shirley Sherrod and NPR. And so it's very interesting that she just went after him and called him out for what he is.
Yep.
And I appreciate Laura Flanders for that. But more recently, I'm wondering if you've been able to determine a direct link between the Wiener photo package of Wiener's Wiener. This is Congressman Anthony Wiener. An outspoken
Wiener's
liberal.
Wiener's alleged Wiener, we should say.
That's true. We don't know whose package that actually is. But the allegation is that he tweeted a photo of a male midriff in underwear to an unsuspecting young woman in the Seattle, Washington area. And Wiener has gotten very frustrated by this and issued some denials and operated with the media in a way that hasn't been completely helpful. But I suspect the fine hand of Andrew Breitbart behind this because they were the first to out this alleged exchange of Twitter messages between the congressman and the woman in Seattle.
Yeah, and well, you know, I'm sure there's more than enough coverage of the Wiener incident and the ins and outs of it and what is legit and what isn't. I will tell you this. I'll give you this from this angle because this is the one that always interested me. Frankly, I don't give a damn about Andrew Breitbart and his buddy O'Keefe and Giles and all them. You know, I don't care what, you know, they do. What I care is how it affects the rest of us and our lives and our country and the way the media basically gives these people a platform, these jackasses and liars and scoundrels, a platform to come out and say whatever they want, to, you know, to refocus the attention of the country from things that actually matter onto this kind of crap and garbage. You know, that's what ticks me off. The CNN gives a platform to Andrew Breitbart to come on and to make these insinuations with no evidence whatsoever about Anthony Weiner, to do this on CNN after all that we know about Andrew Breitbart, after we know about the phony Acorn tapes, after we know about the phony Shirley Sherrod hit jobs, and all of the others. And I could, you know, that's just some of them. I could go down the list of all of these lies and these, you know, bullshit hoaxes that Andrew Breitbart has brought to this country, for CNN to give this guy a platform to say anything, much less make the insinuations that Breitbart did. You know, so as long as I have your air, you know, I wonder if the investigation into Andrew Breitbart being a child molester, I wonder if that's going to, you know, I wonder if people will look into the evidence of what he does with children. I wonder if people will look into that and to determine once and for all whether Andrew Breitbart is a pedophile. Will we finally get to the bottom of that, Peter? You know, these are the sort of insinuations that Breitbart was, you know, given a platform by the media to do. This has to stop. And I join you in applauding Laura Flanders for drawing the line with Breitbart, for doing her best to try to anyway. You're right. Marr gave Breitbart a pass. He does it all the time. And Laura did a great job of standing up for the truth and trying to call Breitbart out for the liar that he is. And whether he's a child molester and pedophile or not, I don't know. I think that's for the authorities to investigate.
Well, he is a smear merchant. Consider that to be undisputed.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting...
That's for sure. That one I will stand behind. Absolutely. His pedophile past, I don't know. I can't speak to.
Right. And one bit of speculation that I read online, and frankly I can't recall where now, is that Clarence Thomas released his financial disclosure reports on the Friday afternoon heading into the Memorial Day weekend, which was approximately the same time that the Weiner Twitter story surfaced.
Yeah.
And it then took on a life of its own through the holiday weekend and on into Tuesday and Wednesday, when Weiner was repeatedly confronted by reporters who kept asking him to deny that it was his package or that he had sent a Twitter message to this young woman.
Yeah.
And I don't know who tweets to whom, and it's none of my business. I don't really need to know. But it is interesting that the story about Clarence Thomas and, in particular, the income that his wife, Ginny, has been generating from forces friendly to people with very important issues that have been decided by this Supreme Court, including Citizens United and the health care reform, which is on appeal and heading toward the Supremes, that the Clarence Thomas disclosure story was effectively buried because, oh, we've got a potential sex scandal. We just replaced the congressman in New York 26 who had sent a picture of himself to a young lady he met on Craigslist.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it's an interesting theory. I have no way of proving the motives or timing of the people who have tried to smear Mr. Weiner.
Well, you know where you said you weren't sure where you had read it about the new disclosure forms. Where you may have read it was Anthony Weiner. He was trying to focus on this, trying to get the word out about Clarence Thomas just prior to this phony scandal hitting.
Mm-hmm.
So is that a coincidence? Who knows? But, yeah, he was trying to get the focus on Clarence Thomas, who did violate the law. And we have the documents showing where he swore that you know, his wife got no income from these groups over the past 20 years. Those documents are also at Brad Blog. He signed them just above the legal notice. Very simple forms that he signed just above the legal notice, which I presume he understands legalese because he's a justice on the Supreme Court, and he ignored them. Or he signed them anyway in violation of the law, and there has been no accountability for that. And now that he has come out and admitted that his wife got $150,000 just in the past year alone from for trying to stop the health care law, yeah, you would think that there would be some shame in this man and that he would recuse himself from the case when it shows up at the Supreme Court. But if I had that $150,000, I would bet you, Peter, that he doesn't and that he feels he's perfectly capable of ruling on this and being completely impartial, because that's the way he operates. That's Clarence Thomas. And, you know, until there's some accountability, until the media decides they can focus on things that matter instead of this Anthony Weiner and Breitbart-created nonsense, the fight continues.
And I want to note that people can get more information about Clarence Thomas and his inaccurate and fudged financial disclosure reports at the website of a group that Brad helped start called VelvetRevolution.us. And I take it that Kevin Zeese has been working on the issues, because there's a new website at protectourelections.org.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Which is a VR campaign. We have a lot of the Clarence Thomas disclosure forms and so forth at protectourelections.org. Yes, thank you.
Very good. Well, Brad, thanks for all the work you do. I wish you were paid commensurately for the service that you provide to our nation.
Thank you. You're very kind. We'll have to figure out that payment sometime in the future.
Well, let me just put in a plug that you accept contributions at bradblog.com. And if some of my listeners have maxed out in their contributions to the Peter B. Collins Show, make Brad a firm number two there, will you, please? Thank you, Brad.
Appreciate it, Peter.
Always good to talk with you.
And you.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. How's that temper of yours? Have you got it under control?
You're upstairs with a boyfriend while I'm left here to listen. I hear you calling his name. I hear the stutter of ignition. I could hear you whispering as I crept by your door. So you found some other joker who could please you.
If anger is an issue for you, I want to recommend a new book that has just been published by Ian Brennan, and it's called Anger Antidotes, subtitled How Not to Lose Your, and then it goes into S with exclamation points, but we're actually allowed to say shit on a podcast, so it's How Not to Lose Your Shit. Ian, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I'm really impressed with what you've done here, and we were talking just before we started the show here. You have a fascinating background in the music business as a producer and a performer. You have promoted concerts, benefit shows. You produced events. It was at Brainwash, it says, a San Francisco laundromat for 5 years.
It is Brainwash, yes.
Yeah, I knew about Brainwash when it first started, and I was working at a radio station just about five blocks away, and I remember hearing about it, but I never actually attended an event there, and I thought it was just so cool to have live music at a place where you could go and do your laundry while you're being entertained.
It's true. It was a great concept. Last I knew, they continue. And it was certainly, as a performer and as someone organizing events, it was a unique place to be as well. Because it was free, so the random things that would occur, not only with the people there to either get food or drink or to do their laundry, but also just the passerbys that would walk in for a moment and sometimes create anger-inducing or angry, incidents themselves.
Now, as a producer, you've worked on two Grammy-nominated releases, one for Ramblin' Jack Elliott, the other for Peter Case. You've also worked with David Hidalgo of Los Lobos, members of TV on the Radio. I'm a little familiar with that group. I think they're from L.A., right?
They're actually from Brooklyn, but their last record, the new one that's just out, was recorded in L.A.
Uh-huh. Also, Corin Tucker of Slater Kinney, the Dirty Dozen Brass Band that I just saw in Sonoma at their new jazzy-type festival a couple of weekends ago. Jonathan Richmond from Berserkly Records, at least deep there in the past. And
right.
Richard Thompson and others. So that's an interesting way of helping people understand that you approach this work in violence prevention, anger management, basically as a day job to support your musical adventures. Is that a fair way to put it?
I think that would be one way of putting it. Over time, I think it certainly started as that, but I think over the decades now, it's become very much real and an entity in and of itself. But they, more than anything, they complement one another. But it's true that certainly with a lot of the benefits and the political events and even some of the artistic projects that might be more niche projects or genre-based, that there's not a lot of money there. In a lot of cases, they're money-losing ventures. So certainly the work, the lecturing and the counseling work is, in many cases, helped finance these other projects in music and entertainment.
And Ian, you told me that you don't have a degree as a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but you have become quite expert in this field. What was your background? Did you grow up in an angry home? Did you develop skills as a mediator in your youth?
I certainly did. Growing up was a pretty volatile environment, and I love my family very much then, and I still do to this day. And fortunately, we're all still around. But it was a very volatile environment, and within that, I certainly learned to play referee sometimes, or to manage my own anger. And over time, I think the challenge for most people is to find the middle, the balance. So for me, the other side of that spectrum of being able to be a limit setter and to be a little tougher with people when it's called for, or firmer, I should say, it has been my personal struggle. And a lot of people that maybe are angry when they're young, I think the struggle is to, get back towards the middle without completely going into a depressive cycle. So, it originated there, and then when I turned 18, I had to find a way to support myself, and the only thing that interested me other than music was psychiatry, so I started working in psychiatric facilities, starting with geriatric facilities, where I literally worked night shifts, changing diapers for 8 hours continuously, which is incredibly incredibly difficult work on a lot of different levels. Physically, it's very draining and difficult work. So I mean, it was kind of a training or even a hazing over the years, and that's the origin of a lot of the curriculum.
And do you remember an early incident where you were called upon and they said, "Hey, get Ian over here," and you successfully defused a situation or helped somebody work through it or get some better understanding of their own reactions? Can you give us an anecdote of one of those early experiences?
Well, there's two sides to that. One side is that when I was very young, and I don't recollect this at all, but when I was I would say before age five, and these are in the days, suburban California, of more parents being home, that the neighboring parents oftentimes called me the preacher, I guess, because I was the one that was always the peacekeeper and kind of the philosopher. And I have no recollection of that, but I guess there's some something to that. As far as professionally, it was not so much like get him over here as much as the job demanded that and expected that, and that the staff would be able to make these interventions. And obviously people do them in different ways, and over time most people learn techniques that are successful more than half the time, hopefully. I guess became evident over time that I was successful more often than not, and because of that, the director of the facility that I was working at the time in Richmond asked me to start training the staff there, and then from word of mouth, people that liked the training that worked elsewhere asked me to come to their facility and train people at the jail or the school or the hospital. As far as the specific incident, the strange thing about working in psychiatry that I've heard many people that have worked in facilities that are locked facilities say this, that oftentimes it's really hard to come up with the stories of the crisis or horror because there's so many that they kind of become indistinguishable to a large degree.
Yeah, interesting. Now, Ian, before we dive into the content of the book, I just want to, for the benefit of our listeners, explain that I'm really impressed with the way the book presents the information. And the graphic design is very strong. You use black and white to identify, essentially, black is the problem and white is the antidote or the solution. And it's very accessible. And I kept the book around for a couple of weeks, and, you know, I'd read it for 10 or 15 minutes and put it down and come back to it. And I found that it's very useful in that way. It doesn't have such a central narrative that, you know, basically you need to read it in one sitting. And also I think that the way many of us operate is that we reach for this at a time when we either want to explore and understand things or maybe even in crisis, when we just lost it, had a meltdown, and want to take a look at that. And I think your book can be useful in either one of those processes.
Well, that's very heartening to hear. That certainly was the intention, is that it's meant to be accessible. It's meant to be something that is not work for people. And the hope is that it could be picked up and read at random, that essentially each chapter, and these chapters are in most cases, you know, 2 to 3 pages. I think the longest chapter is not much beyond that, are really intended as mini manuals, meaning that in self-educating myself in this area for so many decades now, I've read many self-help books, and a lot of them are good, but one observation I have of many of them is that they tend to run out of steam very quickly, meaning that once you've read about the first 50 pages, in many cases once you've read the intro, you pretty much know what the book's about, and everything else after that seems to be just an excuse to turn it into a book. And this is the philosophy of this, and the intention of this was the opposite, was to condense things down in a way that is provocative and stimulating, and not that the book has all the answers by any stretch, but that hopefully there's something in there that will have value to different individuals. And I'm sure to each individual it's probably going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
But the book is intended to be something that somebody doesn't have to pick up and read cover to cover.
Well, that might really piss them off.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Don't want that.
So, Ian, I'm not going to try to replicate your book and go through it step by step, but I'd like to touch on some of the chapters, some of the pages that had meaning to me, and use that as a way to give people a brief tour of the book. And for $15, I hope that many of my listeners who want to explore this area will go out and buy the book and experience it for themselves. You start off with fear, and you call it the nuclear emotion. And when it comes to expressions of anger and those that lead to violence, often the insecurity and the just downright scaredness of the angry individual is a central emotion that drives it all.
That's true, and the trick, I think, and it's something that is ongoing for all of us, is to recognize that most of the things that bother us about other people's behavior, and probably even our own, are fear-based. So whether it's somebody who's critical, whether it's somebody who's judgmental, whether it's somebody who is, you know, angry or hostile or violent or condescending, so many of those behaviors originate from, inadequacy, vulnerability on the part of the other individual that they're overcompensating for. And so what we see is that mask, which is usually going to be the anger. What's beneath it oftentimes is something very different, and that's the fear.
And what stood out for me as a single declarative sentence here, threats are exclusively the province of the threatened. And it's sensible, but in the mix of human emotion, often people who make threats and who use very extreme absolutist language are feeling extremely threatened themselves, and that's what's causing them to lash out and to try to, I guess, visit that same emotion on the people near them.
Right, that's true. And it's the fear of fear that makes human beings especially complex. And it's also the threats that are not physical but that are psychological and emotional that makes human beings especially dangerous, and that we're willing to die physical deaths to protect our egos. And not all of us, but some of us, or to physically injure somebody else in order to, you know, bolster our own self-esteem. So these layers of fear make it all the more toxic and all the more dangerous. But the example I sometimes use is that, you know, when somebody's way off the mark with a threat or with a judgment, it doesn't affect us. But when they're on the mark to some degree, whether we're willing to acknowledge it or not, that's usually what really, you know, triggers us and sets us off and makes us defensive or makes us angry.
Now, I will stipulate that fear has always been present. It's certainly an element of the human experience. But in my view and my political view, fear has become a commodity. And I feel the Bush-Cheney administration tried to scare the American public shitless over threats of terrorism so that they could create a police state, take away our civil and constitutional rights, or at least sharply limit them. And to me, the portal where we come into contact with that is at the airport now, where we have these hardened facilities on the way in, never on the way out. And we've seen in some cases where people have gone in through baggage claim to wreak havoc at an airport. At any rate, the whole process of getting on an airplane now tries to put you in touch with threats and with fear. And you may or may wish to comment on the political aspects of that, but the part that I see is that we have injected fear into our daily lives, and I wonder to what extent you see a kind of measurable but background-level fear that has become more prevalent in American culture.
Well, those points are very strong, and certainly the airport is palpable to me because of all the traveling I do for this work. And it is also probably, for me, the single most consistent source of my own personal frustrations and irritation and even anger.
Yeah.
Is the process and how insensitive it can be, and in many cases how misguided or misapplied it is, in that I think that it's a misinterpretation of what the relationships between individuals are, meaning that we, the passengers, are the whole reason that airport is there. We are the customers, yet we're treated like we are prisoners when we're there. And certainly we know that the fear is real, meaning that 911 was horrific. It was meant to be, and it was, and it had a dramatic effect. But what we hope to do is find balance. And really, a lot of what this book is about is trying to avoid the extremes and find the balance. And certainly the fear is disproportionate to the threat, not only in the airports, but just in modern-day American life. And a lot of that is due to the media, meaning that people are aware of more violence than ever before from across the world and from across the region or the regions where they live. But in reality, violence is going down. We are, you know, we're six times more likely, you know, is the estimate to be killed by somebody in the Middle Ages than we are today.
Well, severe weather events kill more people every year than those who died on 9/11/2001. And
right.
There was a fascinating piece that was in the Wall Street Journal about a year and a half ago. And it was written by the number cruncher who does the website 538.com. And I'm not coming up with his name. But at any rate, he laid out the statistics that showed that actually traveling on an airliner is one of the safest things you can do. And that while there have been incidents that in the last 35 years, they pale in comparison to other daily threats that we take pretty much in stride. Ian, next I'd like to turn to your chapter about emotional immaturity, because this is often a flashpoint in human exchanges that escalate to temper or to violence. And it's one of the things that can be most difficult to read or predict.
Right. You know, people, the reflex question that comes up so often in these type of instances is, what was that person thinking? And the answer is, they weren't thinking. So when we analyze the question, we know that there's something missing there. There's kind of a misstep. And what happens is that these are not intellectual processes. These are emotional in nature. Most of our decision making is, and that's why somebody who can be a double PhD can still act in highly irrational ways, particularly when they're under the influence of something. And that's something else that we know, is that most of the strangest behavior, scariest behavior that we see is usually, goes hand in hand with intoxication of some sort and or a psychiatric disorder, an acute psychiatric disorder of some sort, and sometimes both.
Mm-hmm.
So, this emotional element is so important, because somebody can be 75 years old and a doctor, but that doesn't at all ensure that they're going to behave appropriately.
Mm-hmm. Next, I'm at Chapter 8 here, where you're talking about expectations. And this is, one of those fundamental issues where people who are getting along have conflict because one has inappropriate or unfair expectations of the other, or of just an experience like, oh, I thought that was going to be a really great movie and it sucked. And then you're mad at the person who made you go to it.
Right. And it's those gaps that tend to create the conflict usually. And the most intense ones are when two people have entirely different expectations about what's going to happen or what should happen. And certainly should is the big thing here that we're always looking at. And it's something that's talked about pretty openly and prevalently in a lot of the literature. But it's important to emphasize it that these rules and these ideas about how something should be, when they're inflexible, they're usually what produce violence more than anything else. It's not a anarchy. It's not a looseness. It's a rigidity about how things should be. And when somebody is unwilling to yield to reality, then they're ultimately going to be a very unhappy individual.
Ian, in Chapter 13, you write, anger is self-generated. We don't feel angry as much as we get angry. We make ourselves angry based on how we interpret our experiences. The angrier we get, the angrier we become. We literally get better at it through practice, building neural pathways in the process in the same manner a pianist or basketball star does for their respective arts. Rage proneness is closely linked to rumination and brooding, the unwillingness to forgive and let go, not just getting mad, but staying mad. And for some people, it really is a daily experience. They live in a pool of anger, and they manage to control it to some extent. But there are triggers, some of which are known to the individual, some of which aren't apparent, that can cause them to lose it.
It's true. And that slush fund of anger, that building up of anger that's never really finding an outlet, tends to be the most dangerous. Many people seem to go out into the world looking for targets, looking for something to be angry about, and viewing the world in these extreme ways of right and wrong, black and white, oversimplifying things that are usually much more complex. And that leads to these cycles of anger, which, of course, reverberate, because when we're subjected to anger, that quite naturally probably produces irritation and hostility and defensiveness and fear, you know, on the part of us and most other people. And that's the cycle that we're concerned about, is that you know, the idea that somebody is looking for trouble, or the idea that there are bad people or stupid people, which is a pretty extreme statement. You know, they've certainly done something that was unwise, and maybe they even have a pattern of doing that. But usually there's a lot greater complexity than the angry individual is allowing.
Mm-hmm. Next up, I'm at 18. Extremes are extremely important. And you write, extremes of any sort are unsettling because they almost always lead to imbalances. Wherever there's a disturbance of any kind, extremes of some sort are usually found. Give us an example of what you mean by this.
Well, there's usually the obvious extreme, which is you know, let's say the loud person versus the quiet person, the angry person or the mean person versus the overly nice person. But it could be the overly nice person or the quiet person that in fact is much more dangerous or is maybe the only one who is a threat at all. So it's not to say that on the surface we can know automatically that something's wrong, but it's just certainly that anything that's extreme is something that should be looked at. It's something that should be, evaluated as to, how it got to that point. You know, something that is essentially imbalanced.
Another concept I find interesting here is about boundaries, and some people don't respect the boundaries of others, and some people don't establish sufficient boundaries around themselves. And I'm thinking of people, for example, I've met on an airplane who want to pour out their life story. There are some people who just seem to have a compulsive urge or need to share information that strikes me as, why didn't you keep that to yourself? So talk a little bit about boundaries here and how failure to have appropriate boundaries can lead to conflict with people either in a similar or the opposite position.
It's true that boundaries are usually at play when we see violent actions. And again, violence here is not just physical. It could be emotional. It could be verbal. It can manifest itself in many different ways. But what we know is that when we look at the extremes of physical violence with rape and murder, really, those are the most extreme disrespect and disregard for the individuality of another individual. Many of the most violent individuals demand, respect of their own boundaries to a very extreme degree, but they oftentimes are entirely disrespectful of the needs of others. And it's closely related to one of the main things that is an antidote to violence, which is empathy. That the individual with bad boundaries, whether it's somebody who's just too talkative or somebody who maybe tells a joke that's insensitive, which we've all done on occasion, but somebody who might have a pattern of that, or whether it's somebody who's downright physically aggressive, all those individuals share a lack of empathy, that they're not really aware of what the other person's experience is. And worse yet, they're usually not even curious about what the other person's experience is because they are so absorbed in their own needs.
Yeah. And speaking of that kind of self-absorption, I wanted to set this up with a little musical interlude from Bachman Turner and their buddy Overdrive.
I found out every trick in the book, and that there's only one way to get things done. I found out the only way to the top is looking out for
keep looking out for number one. And that's us, keep looking out for number one. That's me, I'm looking out for
the only way to the top. Is looking out for number one. And isn't that really ingrained in us in all the messages that we get from television and commercial media?
It certainly seems so. And it's that compulsive competitiveness that is so corrosive and so dangerous. It's setting up conflicts that don't necessarily exist and that the other party in many cases probably is unaware of themselves. Again, that oversimplification, that dividing into camps, into right and wrong, into black and white, and winners and losers, inevitably is going to have violent results, meaning somebody is going to lose from that setup.
And just an extreme example, I was reading in the newspaper this morning, there is a criminal case underway in a court in San Francisco where a man is being tried as an adult, but he was, I believe, 15 when the incident occurred. And he and a stranger were riding an escalator up to the movie theaters at the Metreon complex in downtown San Francisco. And some sort of a skirmish resulted because the guy who was behind felt that the person in front of him wasn't going fast enough. And maybe they were on a deadline for a movie to start. I don't know that particular. But the person lower on the escalator pulled out a gun and popped off three shots and killed this person. And that's a very extreme example. But part of the mentality was there. They were on their way to a movie. And so many movies now celebrate violence as a solution. When you come up against an issue where somebody is challenging you or they're even just in your way, well, the Hollywood solution is to pull out a gun and blow them away. And I think that kind of behavior has been modeled so frequently, Ian, that many people have to resist an urge to resort to violence, whether they happen to be packing a gun or not. But road rage is another example of this, where people who are caught in the same traffic jam as somebody else will get so angry and frustrated and take it out on a stranger.
Yes, it's true. I mean, the reactivity, the use of the primitive part of the brain rather than the more developed part of the brain where we are thinking about what we're doing, we are making choices, we're not just being ruled by emotion and passion and kind of these roles of good guy, bad guy, cops and robbers, whatever we want to call it. Is important, but certainly the exposure to it is massive, I think, for most of us, whether that's shoving somebody, whether that's, you know, physically aggressing against somebody in very unrealistic ways that are portrayed in the media, meaning, you know, people withstanding abuse that would, in typical cases, kill them, you know, in real life, and then the guns. But the bottom line of a lot of this that's touched on in the book is that opportunity dictates action. So I can't pull out a knife that I don't have. And it's that step forward toward violence, which means having the knife in the first place, or even having the idea that I need a knife or that I'm going to fight or that I might fight, that certainly contributes to greater violence. And those expectations that the world is a dangerous place, the expectation that I'm going to need to fight or should fight, or that it's even the right thing to do.
And the last side I'd like to cover from the book, Ian, it kind of builds on what you were just describing. And you write here, past orientations, what's done is done. And this is one of the things that is so hard to read. You don't know what another person's history is. You don't know what their emotional history is. And for example, that escalator incident I described to you, it's possible that the guy with a gun had been the victim of a crime. And he decided that he was not going to let that happen to him again and that he would attack before he could be attacked. But our memories and recollections, particularly of crucial emotional incidents, often program us to react in inappropriate ways in a present or future situation.
It's true. and that carryover from, say, you know, more primitive parts of ourselves, or certainly more immature parts of ourselves, you know, can perpetuate or even, you know, worsen that cycle to the point that we regress back to that point, or even further back. And that's the concern. And again, the curiosity is the antidote. The curiosity to rather than assume what the other person's experiencing, to wonder and say, well, what is going on with this person? And the question that a lot of people have is, well, you know, or the idea is, that person that's in front of me in that car is doing this to me. They're doing this to piss me off. They're doing this because they're being passive aggressive. When in reality, the fact is that most of the time, whatever they're doing has nothing to do with us. They're probably driving slowly in front of us because they don't know that we're there. They're just unaware of it. And yes, that probably is an error on their part, that they probably themselves should be more empathic and more curious and more aware. But, you know, but two wrongs don't make a right, essentially.
And I think I lied a minute ago. There is one more thing that I want to pull out of the book that I think is really crucial, and you address it in a number of places. And it is that people often use personal pronouns in heated conversation. And so it becomes a blame game of you did this, or, you know, I expected you to do that. And you counsel people to focus on the inanimate or the more neutral. Instead of what did he do, it's what happened. Explain how these pronouns can be extremely loaded, particularly in heated exchanges, Ian.
Well, there's the UI ricochet, as I call it, and it literally creates this division, this absolute black and white, me against you, us against them line that so much conflict results from. And there's this reciprocity and this escalation that usually becomes asymmetrical, meaning that whatever was done to me or whatever I believe is done to me, I will usually then retaliate with something worse, which then escalates the situation more and more. So you tends to be the bait. You tends to be the thing that provokes the big emotional reaction. I tends to be the argument. So a very common one is that a well-intentioned person will say something to an angry individual like, hey, I know how you feel, I understand what you're going through, but what we know is that most of the time, and we've all experienced this from both ends of it, the response is, no, you don't know what I'm experiencing, to which the other individual then says, yes, I do know what you're experiencing. And so they're dealing with it on this factual level as they see it, which is, you know, right or wrong. What we can do better in these situations, if we choose to have a relationship with that individual, is to focus on what is happening, whether it's right or wrong, what's going on. So they believe that I was trying to hurt them, or they believe that I was trying to do something to them. Whether that's right or wrong is really not relevant at this point. What's relevant is that that's their experience, that's what's causing the behavior. And so knowing that certainly should be helpful to me in terms of making decisions about where to go from here with this individual, or where to not go from here with this individual, which oftentimes is the best solution if it's somebody that we are not mandated to have a relationship with, or we have not chosen to have a relationship with. And so many of these conflicts come from relationships that were not chosen. Two people that are encountering each other at a mini mart, they're standing in line, and suddenly they're having the most intimate of relationships, which is one of physical violence.
Yeah. So, Ian, as we wrap up here, what would you like to leave with our listeners in terms of a helpful message or a set of resources in addition to your book that people should be aware of if they want to take on issues of anger and try to resolve them?
Well, there's many, many books on the subject, maybe too many books on the subject. This particular book, Anger Antidotes, is pretty comprehensive, meaning that, again, it's not just one concept stretched out over an entire book. It's these mini manuals, chapter to chapter. Really, the message ultimately is one of focusing on us, focusing on we, focusing on what we can do together and the future rather than the past, that there are solutions usually, and that ultimately there need to be solutions, that in that, okay, maybe this bad thing did happen, but we can't change that. What we can do now is what we can do now, and that's where the focus should be with the other individual. So literally, the antidote to the UI communications that we were talking about a moment ago is the word us. Quite literally, is to talk about us. Let's see what we can do. Let's do this. What can we do? As opposed to, you know, the right and wrong UI ricochet that people get into so often.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us, and I heartily recommend the book. It's Anger Antidotes, How Not to Lose Your Shit. It's out in softcover, $15 from W.W. Norton, and we've been talking with Ian Brennan. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you so much.
Oh, Shante, Shante, sing a little Paris song. Shante, Shante, I sing along.
And just one more thing on this podcast. I'm going to be away for a few days and won't be able to deliver a fresh podcast for about a week. And last night, we went to the movies and saw Woody Allen's new flick, Midnight in Paris. Kathy and my stepson David and I all really enjoyed it. And so I thought I'd share Gary Chu's latest review of Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris. Gary, take us to France, will you?
If you pay close attention, there are two clues that tip you off right away that this movie wasn't shot in Dallas. First, there's the title. And second, and more obviously, the film was written and directed by Woody Allen. Remember him? Midnight in Paris is about escaping one's present and gorging on a previous era that, to you, was a much better time to live a life. Or at least it seems so, depending on what era you're living in. That's where Gil, played by Owen Wilson, finds himself. He and his fiancée Inez, played by Rachel McAdams, are on an extended Paris holiday with Inez's extremely well-off parents, John, Kurt Fuller, and Helen, played by Mimi Kennedy. Gil doesn't do badly himself. He's a Hollywood scriptwriter who, by implication, might churn out scripts for those movies like Mr. Wilson has been seen in a lot over the years. Could this be more evidence of the sharp sword of Woody Allen's poetic justice at work? And so, a vacation in the City of Love enhances Gil's longing to bail on the rat race of Hollywood, for good, and to move to Paris, for good, and finish what he hopes will be his great novel. He has just a bit more polishing to do on it. But wait till you see who Gil gets to critique his tome. Oh, whoops, ahead of myself I get. Meanwhile, another clue presents itself. As you can plainly infer, Owen Wilson is playing the Woody Allen part in Midnight in Paris, and he's super doing it, even though he's way more West Coast than any Alvy Singer kind of a struggling writer is East Coast. That and the fact Wilson doesn't wear horn-rimmed glasses doing the role are the only things that make him seem a little un-Allen-ish. On the other hand, what is so way Allen-ish is that Maestro Woody has dressed his latest photoplay in the usual female eye candy he's been known for over the decades. Rachel McAdams clearly makes a considerable contribution to that aspect of the film, but she's not the only lady to provide the visual confection for a fellow to scan. Woody, you old dog. McAdams' Inez is very well acted as well. She's the beautiful, spoiled young daughter of wealthy Republican parents. Allen always works some of his humor along political lines, in case you've forgotten. These parents are quietly dismayed at Gil's romantic artistic bent, even though he works at turning out American motion picture product for the masses in Southern California. The stuff that Inez's mom and dad want to do in Paris, along with Inez and her pals, a couple, Paul, played by Michael Sheen, and Carol, played by Nina Arianda, is not what Gil hankers for. Gil hopes to suck up the history of the organic Paris and its denizens, and as Woody Allen would have it, that means Gil enjoys taking late-night strolls solo around what is surely one of the most beautiful cities on this planet, and maybe any planet. The big joke in Midnight in Paris that's underscored in a very cool way at the end of the film with the help of a private detective is that Gil does a little time-traveling, a la Française, without benefit, thank goodness, of gimmicked scientific manipulation. Allen merely tasks his film editor to cut from one scene in 21st century Paris to another showing characters of an earlier time living and partying in La Ville Lumière. Since the facade of Paris has changed so little over time, you hardly notice. The time shifts occur without fanfare and bring the moviegoer to slowly realize that Gil is no longer talking to the chiding, out-of-touch Inez or the anally pedantic Paul. Gil is now in a classy bar chatting it up with an American named Fitzgerald, played by Tom Hiddleston. By the way, the lady on Fitzgerald's arm is a Southern belle, also from the States, named Zelda, played by Alison Pill. Many such characters give wing to this really entertaining PG-13 Allen tale. Would you believe Gertrude Stein, played by Kathy Bates, Salvador Dali, played by Adrian Brody, and Ernest Hemingway, played by Corey Stoll? Other celebrities who show up for smaller bits of the clever fun are Cole Porter, Josephine Baker, Juan Belmonte, Alice B. Toklas, Picasso, Buñuel, Matisse, Toulouse-Lautrec, Gauguin, and Degas. And don't forget, Scott and Zelda know how to party, too. But how come no Igor Stravinsky in all this Another Time in Paris? Other important female roles are Adriana, played by Marion Cotillard, Gabrielle, played by Léa Seydoux, and the museum guide, played by Carla Bruni. Watch closely, though. You might get Ms. Seydoux and Miss Bruni mixed in your mind. And not surprisingly, Miss Cotillard shines as she really turns Gil's head. Not to let old Woody Allen movie fans down, the maestro has included really appropriate vintage music on the soundtrack that makes you want to, for some reason, get up in the theater and shout, "Django Reinhardt!" But if I could, I do need to have a private chat with Woody. "Mr. Allen, you've got to do something about the font you use on those credits of yours." I'm Gary Chu, up, over, and down in the valley.
Well, I hope we've got you all simmered down and mellowed out. Send me an email, humblehost@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until